Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Coming up today, the Nimbin Museum. It's just burnt down, so we'll be looking at the history of Nimbin and how this town has evolved over the years. That's coming up. Also today, the story of Jandamurra. Some call him the Ned Kelly of the Kimberley, but his story is much more complex than that. It's a story of Indigenous resistance against settlement in the Kimberley. And author Mark Greenwood's children's book is a bloody and sometimes confronting account. So today he'll explain why he thinks it's the type of story Australian kids should be learning about. That and more coming up today on Bush Telegraph. A report into the 2009 Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria says logging was partly to blame for the fire's intensity and severity, and the danger of more fires erupting in the same area will remain for decades. Some of the report findings are proving controversial. You'd know that 173 people died and more than 2,000 homes were destroyed in those fires, the worst in Australia's history. Professor David Lindemar from the Australian National University and Chris Taylor, Research Fellow at Melbourne University, authored the report. Welcome to you both. David, I'll start with you. What's the report actually saying?
What the report's saying is that the main driver of fire severity is weather, but once you take that into account, the history of logging on a site also has a significant effect, and what it does is it elevates the severity of the fire. And Chris Taylor, my colleague, has led this really important study to indicate that what we do in the forest actually has an effect on how severe the fire can be.
Chris, what type of logging are we talking about here?
We're talking predominantly clear fell logging, which is pretty much where an area of forest is cleared, all merchantable trees are taken off-site, and the remaining debris is burnt under a high-severity slash burn.
Okay, and what types of forests have you been looking at?
For our particular study, it is the mountain ash forests of the Central Highlands.
Okay, so why, it seems counterintuitive that logging, removing trees, increases a fire risk. How is that the case?
Okay, so it's not the actual logging that causes the fire risk, it's what happens after the logging. So after the slash burn, following the clear fell logging operation, an ash bed is created primarily to promote an abundance of regrowth of new seedlings of mountain ash. The stocking rates of those mountain ash are very, very high, so you have millions and millions of these seedlings. And when they grow very thick and they're competing for light and nutrients. And then after about 7 years, the suppressed seedlings start to die out, and that produces quite an abundance of fine flash fuels. And that's where we actually see this high risk period of growth emerge.
Okay, so a tree, a mountain ash tree?
Yes.
Is prone to burning once it's over 7 years of age. Is that what you're saying?
Well, collectively, it's the whole group of trees. So each tree, there are millions of seedlings growing up. They're all competing for light and nutrients, and they're competing against each other, and they're trying to suppress each other. So the ones that get suppressed die. And as they die, they become dry, and they produce an abundance of fine fuel, which provide fuel or flash fuel for a fire coming in.
David, you have been studying these forests for a very long time. How different is the situation Chris is describing there to what would happen naturally in a forest?
Well, naturally what happens in a forest is that it's not logged, that's for a start. But normally what would happen in these forests is they age. The forest thins out naturally, so we might start with 500,000 seedlings almost directly after logging or after a fire, and then by the time the forest is about 250 years old, there might only be 30 or 40 dominant trees left in the forest, and they'll be very widely spaced, and on the forest floor there'll be a deep and luxuriant layer of tree ferns, very large moss-covered logs which are very wet, and a rainforest understory that's developing. And this very mesic condition is actually one of the things that can reduce the severity of fire quite significantly in the forest. What actually happens also when a forest is logged, and I think this is a really important point to make, is that 60% of the biomass in a logged forest actually stays in the forest. and is left as logging slash. When there's a regeneration fire that's burning that slash, about 30% of the forest slash is emitted to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. The remaining 30% actually stays in the forest, and it adds to the fuel load in the regenerating young stand. And that's one of the things that Chris and I believe contributes to the severity of the fire once a forest gets to 7 years or older.
You talk of severity and intensity. Chris, what is the difference?
Okay, so intensity is the energy output of a fire. Severity is the impact of the fire on the vegetation. So how severe has the vegetation burnt?
Mm-hmm. And what, when you looked at the areas that burnt on Black Saturday, did you look at proportions? Did you break it down into the areas that burnt that were logged versus not logged?
Yeah, we grouped the forest into specific age group categories, and then we assessed the proportion of each age group category in terms of what type of fire burnt through there. So the highest severity fire usually results from a crown fire. That's where the fire leaps out of the treetops. Your more lower severity fires burn in the understory, so it might just scorch or blacken the trees above it. So what we worked out is the area sustaining a particular type of fire and severity impact of that fire. So what we found was roughly about 70 to 80% of trees in between the ages of 15 to 40 years, roughly, give or take a few, carried the high severity fire, crown fire, and we saw that dramatically drop off to the older age classes up to 300 years.
Why does the risk fall away after 40 years? I would think that a crown fire is still a possibility in an older tree as well.
Well, we did detect some crown fire in the older forest, but it was much, much lower, around about 10% of the area, as opposed to the 80% figure that we saw in the 15-year age class. The reason, there are a number of factors. As what David, my colleague, correctly said, that there is a much more luxuriant forest understory, such as tree ferns, rainforest species, that actually form a protective layer that holds more moisture in the forest than, let's say, younger stands. And the crowns of the trees are a lot higher. They're up to about 50, 60, 70 metres above the ground. So it takes a lot more for a fire to get up and ignite those crowns. So there's a greater variation of the vertical fuel layer, which makes it harder for the fire to burn into.
David, what's the proximity to the areas we're talking about here and some of the towns that burned in Black Saturday?
Well, some of the towns in this area which are relatively close to fairly intensively and extensively logged mountain ash and alpine ash forests include places like Healesville, Warburton, Powelltown, Noogee, Tangible Bren. So there's quite a number of these towns which are fairly adjacent to where some of these industrial logging operations are taking place.
We're talking about a region here probably an hour or so drive to the east of Melbourne, broadly speaking.
That's right. It's about an hour and a half's drive from the MCG. Mm. So these are quite important towns, and I think there's a real concern in terms of how close these kinds of logging operations are taking place to these towns, but also how much logged forest there is out there now, 47,100 hectares by our calculations, and also the plans to log another 17,655 hectares in the next few years, which will convert those forests in about 10 years' time to something which is very fire-prone.
Okay, so that's the future, but given the study of this study that we're discussing, how do you assess the current future risk at the moment, given the regrowth in the area?
Chris, I'll hand that to you.
What we actually need to do is, a lot of forest has been burnt in the 2009 fires. That has generated a lot of regrowth on its own. There's not much we can do about that. However, we can control the amount of young stands that we create through logging. And given that so much of the mountain ash forest has either been logged or burnt, remaining areas are of the utmost critical importance. And so these areas must be recognised not only for their biodiversity conservation values, but also for the fact that they will be far less inclined to carry the high severity fires that we've seen in these younger stands. And that is of the utmost importance for governments to look into and address.
So is this an argument against future logging of mountain ash?
Well, I must state that both David and I are not anti-logging. We want to make that very clear. However, the current logging regime in these forests putting these forests in a highly compromised state, and that's what has to change. And so in the past, what we've advocated for is an expansion of the protected reserve network area so that greater areas of mountain ash are protected. And if any logging were to persist, it would be in the smallest proportions where the effects would be negligible.
David, in some ways, that message is very much in line with what you've said in the past when you discuss protecting Leadbeater's possum in the area. You've raised the your concern about logging and its impact on the habitat around there. For some people, this it'd be a case of, well, of course, David Lindemeyer is saying this, wouldn't it? It's in line with what you've said in the past. You're seen by some as a critic of the industry.
Well, I think the bigger issue here is now the cumulative body of evidence from a number of different dimensions that kind of add up to the same thing. And that is that we know from a carbon perspective, for example, that current logging regimes essentially create emissions equivalent to one-third of your lawn power station every year. So the forest industry is a significant emitter of carbon at the moment. We know that current logging operations significantly impair the water supply for the city of Melbourne. We know that logging operations have a major negative effect on biodiversity, and these are all things that we've done detailed empirical studies on over the last 31 years.
But they are also an industry that produces products that we buy and want and generates income,
well, primarily
jobs.
It's producing paper, and the key issue here is that now we don't need 75-year-old trees, which is the dominant age class in this forest, to produce paper. We actually know that there's more plantation feedstock to make paper than there is of ash, and you can actually make better paper from plantation fibre.
Okay, so we're getting into an argument that's slightly separate to the report here. What do you think the timber industry, the forestry industry, should be doing as a result of your report?
I think it's quite clear now from an economic perspective, a carbon perspective, a water perspective, a biodiversity perspective, and a potential tourism perspective, that the industry be helped to make a transition into plantation feedstock as soon as possible, now that we also have compelling evidence of the relationships between logging and fire. I think really now we have to think deeply about the values of these ecosystems and how, when we change them, we increase significantly the risks of other things like fire and those impacts on human communities. And what I'm really saying is that all of the evidence now points very strongly towards the need to make an urgent transition to maintain a forest industry but base it around a plantation feedstock to make paper, which is largely what's coming from these forests. And this is really just another piece of very important evidence which is indicating what happens when we significantly modify their systems the way we have.
Yeah, Chris, just last one to you. So this is a peer-reviewed study, but yes. How controversial has it been in academic circles? There's some that I understand don't agree with its findings.
Well, look, my review of the criticism, if you want to call it that, is that there was one such paper that was published before ours dismissing any kind of relationship between the impacts of logging, stand age and fire severity. But the data that they actually present confirms our findings. It actually shows a similar trend. We just put ours through a formal statistical analysis. Much of the criticism that is coming back now is that the amount of logging is so small it's tenuous. But I must stress that the mountain ash forest in the Central Highlands covers about 15% of the forest area. However, nearly 60% of the logging occurs within that small area. And as the figures that David mentioned before, the 47,100 hectares that have been logged since 1964, that is actually a sizable chunk out of that total 120,000 hectares.
There's some photos on our website which will point out for people the difference between age and fire impact if they'd like to see for themselves. Chris, thank you for coming in. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Chris Taylor, and my thanks also to you, David, Professor David Lindemeyer from the Australian National University, and Chris Taylor, Research Fellow at Melbourne University. This is Bush Telegraph on RN.
Kirsten Drysdale from Talking Shop here, and I'm here to tell you to be afraid, be very afraid, because on the last episode, we looked at how marketers use fear to get us to buy things. It was the final episode of Talking Shop, where my colleague Paul Harrison and I unraveled the world of marketing spin and consumer psychology. You can get all the episodes, from luxury to ethical shopping to showing how you actually can buy happiness. Talking Shop. Download the series from the RN website.
We cross to Nimbin very soon. The Nimbin Museum has burnt down. So we'll discuss what's happened and a little bit of the history of Nimbin as well. That's coming up very soon. First, though, Kath McAloon joins me with Rural News. Kath, let's talk live exports first. We've resumed live cattle exports to Egypt, but I'm guessing there's a few challenges about at the moment, given the relationship between the countries?
Yeah, there's been some, tension between the countries, some diplomatic differences would be one way of putting it. The Greens had been calling for Egypt to face sanctions in the wake of Australian journalist Peter Greste being jailed over there. And Arab nations had also been angered by the Australian government over their sort of status around what they call East Jerusalem, whether it's occupied or disputed, that had angered many Arab nations. And they'd been threatening, you know, perhaps to not buy some Australian produce. But the Egyptian ambassador, Dr. Hassan Al-Laithi, says neither issue has harmed trade between Egypt and Australia. And he says that Egypt's 90 million consumers mean that there's plenty of opportunities to expand trade between the countries.
During the last few weeks, the exports from Australia to Egypt has been resumed, the livestock, and both sides are trying to accommodate the wishes of our sides to serve the interest of the farmers here and the importers from the other side.
Okay, well, it's interesting to see how that evolves, the resumption of that trade. Let's talk back home now. Apparently electric cars could be the answer for, rising fuel bills in remote Australia. How's this going to work?
Yeah, a cooperative research centre in central Australia has been looking into sort of the cost of transport in remote areas, and it says that electric cars could make it cheaper to get around in remote communities.
They don't go far enough, though, do they? Don't they run out of
gas? Well, the idea is they'd be one sort of option. You'd still use your big four-wheel drives for long trips, but just for, visiting your mates a bit down the road, perhaps an electric car might work. The group focuses on remote economic development. They released a report that shows that transport is 2 to 3 times higher in the bush compared to the city. Managing Director Jan Ferguson says that electric cars would require significant investments, like setting up charging stations, but she says it'd be worth it.
You know, we've got 18% of people at the moment who, according to this research, can't travel when they need to due to lack of transport. So maybe we need to be looking at some other options, because if, as a community, there's a nation incurring expense because of that lack of transport, there may be some cost trade-offs where it's cheaper to ride the transport.
Because if I live in the Barkly Tablelands, let's say, and I'm going to catch up with my mate at the Bark Hut for a beer, I could be up for a 600-kilometre round trip.
True, yeah. So, and you're not going to find a charging station somewhere along the way.
Maybe not, yeah. So some challenges there, but an interesting study nonetheless. Let's finish up talking bilby poo. Why on earth is that in the news?
Really interesting. Queensland researchers have come up with a new way to measure stress levels in endangered bilby species. Now, this is important to know if they're stressed or not, because apparently, bilbies that are less stressed have better breeding results. They breed better when they're not as stressed. Mm-hmm. Now, previously, the researchers had tested for the stress hormone cortisol by taking a blood sample from the bilby, which in that process itself caused stress to the animals. But now they can measure it by just looking at their poo. So Griffith University professor Jean-Marc Hero says the study of bilby poo has already shown that stress levels are low in captive breeding programs, which is good news, because they're hoping to release some of those bilbies bred in those programs into the wild. And Professor Hero says the scat testing technique will now be used to study wild bilby populations, which are on the brink of extinction.
They're pushed right out into their extreme desert conditions where cats, the feral cats, cannot survive. They're estimate for Queensland is somewhere between 400 and 1,000 wild bilbies left, but we really have no idea until we can actually determine a good methodology for detecting such an extremely rare species.
Okay, what an interesting study. We'll leave it there. Thanks,
cheers,
Kath.
Cam.
Kath McAloon with today's Rural News. Something else that's grabbing national attention, I think I can say, this morning is the fact that Nimbin, the country New South Wales town that's really known for its hippie and alternative culture, has lost its museum. Overnight, a fire destroyed the museum and several other businesses. Michael Balderstone is the Nimbin Museum Director. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Cameron, is it?
Yes, so you got Cameron here. Now, sorry to hear about the fire. How significant was the museum?
The fire is really significant. It's not just the museum. It's the Rainbow Cafe next door, a couple of other shops as well. It's the heart of town. It's the middle of town. It looks like someone's knocked its the two front teeth out of Nimbin, really.
It's a big
fire.
Do you know how it started?
No, I got a phone call about 4 in the morning, and like, I live out of town, so 10 kilometres from town we could see the glow, and I knew, oh God, it's, you know, it looks huge. And got into town, it started in the backyard of the Rainbow Cafe, they reckon, and then spread, jumped across the laneway into the museum, which is part of 4 shops, a big building. So it's all gone, razed to the ground. I mean, the firefighters did a great job. I was amazed it didn't spread. We were really lucky there was no wind at all, because the whole street is like, you know, 100-year-old wooden building.
Yeah, so the museum itself, what have you lost there? What was in the collection?
We've lost everything. It wasn't a normal museum. It was a community space as much as anything, and I made it with friends, artist friends from a community. We made it 22 years ago, although it was like a never-ending project, really to try to communicate to people what happened to Nimbin, why it's so different, what we're about, what's the alternative movement about. So it was as much art as a museum. But having said that, there were heaps of bits and pieces of memorabilia that hasn't been composted, which happens to lots of hippie stuff, that were in there that are irreplaceable. You know, just... You know, even the last Bentley gas blockade, coal seam gas, you know, the lock-ons were in there, things like that. The old combi that Bob Hawke's daughter lived in when she was up here, got him to shed a tear. That's burnt to a frazzle. You know, it's all, everything. It was a very genuine museum. We put our heart and soul into it and all gone.
Michael... I can hear that you're distressed about it.
Yeah, it's double C, you know. So it's all good. It won't worry Nimbin, the community. We're very resilient. It's a terrific movement here, but...
Yeah. What was the attraction to Nimbin? How did this alternative community actually get started?
I think it happened in 1973 when they held the universities. The Union of Students, Australian Union of Students, held a sort of back to the earth, I've got to keep my act together here, back to the earth movement. They held a festival and it was so successful they bought the land and then Nimbin really became a centre for that counterculture, an earth first culture. It was about, you know, different values, a spiritual thing.
Mm. Is that still the case? Is it still a genuine movement in Nimbin, or has it become something of a caricature of itself?
Oh, no, I think it's a very genuine movement. And you know, we've got children and grandchildren here now who grew up on the communes. No, I can't talk. Take a big breath. No, I just, it's very, it's got deep roots, Nimbin. It's very real.
So clearly it's a tough day, tough day for you, Michael.
You talk to me, I'll try and get my hopeless.
We are hearing...
I'm back on top now.
Yeah, you're
so
okay.
It is very genuine, Nimbin, and ironically, a bit on the back of Byron Bay, we've become quite a big tourist attraction. We're busy, you know, the museum... was a big part of the tourism, but the street scene is a big part of the tourism. This is the... You know, if Nimbin was in India, it'd be a holy town. There's a lot of people here who probably get rejected, come to live on the street. it's a refugee camp from the stupid war on drugs.
Yeah, all right, Michael. So clearly a tough day.
I'm sorry about that. But anyway, it's a very strong community of outsiders, you'd have to say, or people who have different values, who think we need to change our attitude to each other and the earth. And it's very solid, and, you know, it'll hardly be a blip on the evolution of Nimbin, but it's big in the context of the village and probably tourism a bit. Although that'll keep happening.
Yeah.
So it's a busy little town now. It's the only town, little village in New South Wales. You can never get a park.
It's a tough day. Thanks for joining us, and good luck with the future endeavours and the rebuild. Appreciate your time.
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologise at all. Michael Balderstone, who is the Nimbin Museum Director, with the news that the museum and a handful of shops in the main street of Nimbin there have burnt down. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you, RN and Radio Australia. He was known as Jundamurra to his people and as Pigeon to white fellas. He lived over 100 years ago in the Kimberley. He was a warrior, a hero to some, but regarded as a villain to others. And children's author Mark Greenwood has brought him to life again. He's a finalist now in the Children's Book Awards, the Information Book of the Year. It's to be announced this Friday. Mark, thanks for joining Bush Telegraph.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Some of your books in the past have focused on quite well-known Australians. What attracted you to Jundamurra?
Over the years, as a writer, one of my passions is Indigenous literacy. So I've worked over the years for many times in various remote communities throughout West Australia and Central Australia, and I often came up to a lot of the schools, and I originally wanted to find a story that I thought was important for Indigenous children, that they would enjoy reading, and also a story that was important for non-Indigenous kids as well, and, you know, grown-ups as well, but mainly it was a story that I hoped that would be read by all people and appreciated, and it was prompted by my various travels up into the Kimberley.
How would you describe Jundamurra?
Oh, I think he was an incredibly important man. In a way, when you look at stories like our great, stories of Australian history, and when you compare perhaps him with someone like a Ned Kelly, there's always going to be that comparison where some people say he was a hero, other people say he was a villain. And like you said there in the introduction to the Bunuba people themselves, he's a very important leader. And they still feel that his presence is still felt very strongly in the country and in the area and, you know, in the people's lives in that area. So he's an important person because he stood up for his people. But, of course, he walked in both worlds for a period of his time because in the early days he spent a lot of his early time working on state. It's a lot of his skills that eventually he used against the settlers and the police. He learnt them from the white people that he was working with, the station owners, to, you know, ride and to shoot and to do all those things that he became very famous for. So I just think he's one of those interesting characters, and as writers we're always drawn to characters, and he had that duality that I always love.
Because a lot of Australians haven't heard of Jundamurra, but what do we say? He essentially led a resistance against white settlers in the Kimberley. Is that a very simple way of putting it, but a fair description?
It's a fair description. It is a simple way. One of the things that I think that makes Jundamurra stand out from others is that he fought back. He resisted also with the same weapons that the police were using against him. And often we've had resistance in the early frontier of Australia, and we've had police and settlers using rifles, and the only weapons that they had against them were spears and what have you. And Jundamurra had, as I said, he was a crack shot with a rifle, and in the end he knew that he would need to arm some of his Bunuba fellows, other people that were there, other warriors. He would need to arm them. So there was a period of time where he robbed a stagecoach, and you're almost getting back into those days when you read about the, you know, Native American Indians and those sort of things. And he was just one of those guys. And he was very dangerous because he was such a good shot and he knew his country so well. So he posed a real threat for the settlers and the police up there. And as I say, because he was using their own weapons or the same weapons against them, they felt very threatened by his presence.
Mm. And at times they thought he was on the police thought he was on their side. We're talking about a time what late in the 19th century here around the Kimberley. How are you presenting this story? Is it history to children, or is it more of a mythical story?
Well, I wanted to, when I wrote my book, there have been a couple of fantastic books written about Jundamara. One of them written for adults, Jundamara and the Buddha of the Resistance, by Howard Pedersen. And it's a very well-researched book, and it's very factual. And then a while back, a few years ago, a children's book came out called Kimberley Warrior. And again, it was a very factual book, very information-based book. I wanted to present this story, the book that I did, I wanted to present it more as an oral story, because I think that a lot of times, especially in Indigenous storytelling, there's that element of oral storytelling. And also, he did have a very mystical element about him. There was a time when he worked for the tracker, as a tracker for police, and then he worked for his own people. He turned against the police and freed his own people. He became a renegade to the police and the settlers, and he was badly wounded, and he went into a very amazing place up in the Kimberley tunnel, known as Tunnel Creek today. And it was said in there that he changed, and he became this mystical figure that could disappear and appear like a ghost, and could shape-shift, turn into a bird and fly away. And he had all these other elements of storytelling that I found really, those are the things that I wanted to capture. And so I'm presenting him as a mystical figure, but a figure nevertheless from Australian history that was real and existed. And then asking, one of the things I was asked when I wrote the story, and I worked with one of the senior Buddha elders up there, Mr. Dylan Andrews, was that to present him as the Buddha people wanted him to be presented, as they wanted him, as they wanted his image and his story to be reflected and told. So I've tried to incorporate that as much as I possibly could.
So did you draw more on the stories of the region and the people on the region for your book rather than the historical documents?
I used a lot of historical documents, and I found down in Perth, there's in the state records office, there's all the records of the police who were chasing Jundamara at a certain time. All that information is there to be found. But I found that the best way to get inside the story of Jundamara was with the people that know that country really well. And also, as I said, Mr. Andrews up there, Dylan Andrews, who knows the story really well, has been taking people, showing people many of the sites of the Jundamara story. And I wanted to go to some of the ones that were very remote and very different. And he took me there. And whilst I travelled with him, I got an understanding that this was such an important story to the Buddha people. It needed to be done really well, and it needed to be done with their consent, and it needed to be done with them to also look at what I'd written. And so over the period of time that we developed the story, they had an opportunity to look at the manuscript and advise me and give me advice, and some of the advice I had from Mr. Andrews and a wonderful woman up in Fitzroy Crossing, June Oscar, who's very well known up there. Some of the suggestions were absolutely terrific, and I think they just enhanced the way that I was telling the story and made it something that they were proud of as well.
One of the significant sites in his story is the old hollow Boab tree that was known as the prison tree. Jundamara reputedly being held there. Did you visit that site?
I visited that site. I just find those stories so distressing in a way. My home is Fremantle, and I spent many years over in Rottnest Island, and I know the history of the island. And when I think about all those fellows that were sent there for stealing a sheep or stealing a cattle, and they were taken all the way from the Kimberley, through the Kimberley, and then spent time in that Boab tree prison, and then eventually were sent down to an island very south where it was cold. And I just, when I go to places like that, it just makes me shiver.
Mm-hmm. Boab trees too. They're such beautiful objects and such a significant symbol of the Kimberley, and then to have them associated with that sad element of the story.
I know. Mm. So yeah, I've had children in Derby write about that, and some of the things that the Indigenous kids have written about the Boab tree when I went up there and workshop with them again made me really conscious that the people up there know exactly what those trees were, and they and what was going on there. And they have a, as I said, it makes me shiver, and in the same way, I think that it makes them shiver remembering the past.
Mm. You've also written about Ned Kelly in the past. Now, very, very different characters, but there are some similarities you can draw, obviously.
Yeah.
Ned Kelly is so well known. John DeMuro, I would say, is not. Why do you think he should be known to all Australians?
Well, I think his story is just as important as Ned Kelly's story. And there's always the argument about whether Ned Kelly, you know, as I said before, whether he was a hero or not. And that's for everyone to judge and to make their own and form their own opinions about. It's just that there are people in Australian history like John DeMuro whose story has been not well known, perhaps because of the remote region and perhaps because at that time his story wasn't as well publicised in newspapers as the Kelly outbreak was, you know, with the Kelly gang. That was very well publicised, not just in Australia. His story made it all the way around the world to England and various other countries. And John DeMuro's was in a very remote region, and the Australian or the West Australian government at the time, when they feared for the fact that the, you know, police were up there in very remote areas, wanted this problem sorted out. And in a way, it was a sort of a problem that they wanted as quiet, dealt with as quietly as possible. And that's the way it's remained. It's remained a story that was dealt with a long time ago as quietly as possible. But as I said, for the Bunuba people up there, it's a very, very important story. It's a story that lives in their hearts. And I firmly believe sort of the way that they say that they feel that John DeMuro exists up there, still he still sort of is there. He's in the country. He's part of the country. He's part of them. And so I just think that sometimes those stories, they need to be told. And I think that a lot of, you know, my book is aimed for upper primary, early secondary students, and it's part of their curriculum studies now, those early frontier wars and what happened. And they need to know some of those stories. And so the more stories that are unearthed, the better.
But it's a confronting story, though. How hard is it to write a story like this for that age group?
It's a very confronting story. And there are parts of the story where when John DeMuro was imprisoned himself and returned to his own country and he saw what was happening to his people, and there were terrible things at that time happening to the people around the Fitzroy Crossing area and all around the north of West Australia and other parts of Australia as well. But what do we do? Do we continue to keep that history quiet, or do we now reveal it and let people understand and know? I think that sometimes when non-Indigenous people sort of go up to these areas and meet Indigenous people, There is always that mistrust is still exists a lot, and you can understand why when you know what happened, and you also know that some of this was only a generation away. It wasn't that far away a generation or two away that these events happened. So I think the more that we understand and the more we are sorry for those things that have happened, the better.
Well, thanks to this book, there will be more young Australians in particular who know the story. The book is John DeMuro. It's published by Allen and Unwin. It's a finalist in the Children's Book Award in the Information Book category to be announced this Friday. Mark, thank you for joining us today, and best of luck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Author Mark Greenwood. The illustrations in the book by Terry Denton, they don't shy away from the content. There's rifles, Aboriginals in chains. There's some blood as well, all in a kid's book. So we've been asking the question this morning on our Facebook page, how do you think primary students should learn about Australia's hidden and sometimes bloody past, and what other stories should be told? We've got a couple of examples of illustrations from the book on that page. Georgiana says, I've always felt angry that I wasn't told what happened and that I grew up to be embarrassed about not knowing anything really about my country. It's shameful that children are not taught about Aboriginal culture first in our schools. We owe it to the first people of this land to do so. And Gordon says, in part, while learning European and world history is important, it is definitely more important to learn the whole spectrum of our history, warts and all. If you've got a view or you'd like to see those illustrations, you can go to the Bush Telegraph Facebook page and share your thoughts with us there. The paddocks of southeast Australia, they're just starting to bloom at the moment with the yellow of canola in flower. Now, this is a crop that's used for spreads and oils. It's also a lubricant, and you'll even find it as an ingredient in lipstick. But this year's crop is, some of it, in areas, is being decimated by a disease that, at this stage, there's no known remedy for. Dr. Ken Young is a plant health manager with the Grains Research and Development Corporation, and Trent Potter is an agricultural consultant in Narracourt, also vice president of the Australian Oilseeds Association. Welcome to both of you. Trent, before we talk about the disease, a little bit about the crop. What's it actually worth to Australia?
Oh, it's worth, we reckon it's worth over $3 billion in oilseeds, all told. Canola production in the last few years has been over 3 million tonnes a year. In fact, in 2012, we reached over 4 million tonnes, so it's getting to the stage of being a big crop.
Mm. How diverse is its uses? There's obviously the spreads and the oils. What else?
It's used a lot in cooking oil. In the last few years, we've also been selling a lot of Australian canola has been going to Europe for biodiesel production. Obviously, they haven't been able to produce enough in their own countries for biodiesel, so there's a wide range of end uses, and we only crush about 700,000 or 800,000 tonnes of canola seed a year in Australia, so all the rest of it is exported.
So it's a valuable industry for farmers and for rural Australia.
Exactly.
Dr. Ken Young, this disease, how much damage is it causing?
Well, it depends where you are. In places in South Australia, it has caused total top loss in paddocks, and the paddocks have been re-sown. In other areas, it's causing a little bit of damage, but not too much. So it depends where you are within Australia. Obviously, South Australia, in the north and also in the air, but as we come across into the Mallee, Victorian Mallee, South Australian Mallee, there's a reasonable amount of damage has been done, but as we go further north, the damage has been decreased.
Do you feel that if this was a disease in our banana plantations or lettuces, that it would be getting a lot more attention?
I suppose so. I mean, this disease, it occurs every year in Australia. It's just the magnitude of disease this year. That's, I suppose, given the focus for us and obviously the growers. But yeah, if it's, I suppose we go back to when there was a banana drought on. Yes, everybody knew what happened up with the cyclone hitting Queensland. Mm-hmm. But with canola being a bigger commodity product, yes, not as noticeable at the end user.
Yet we're talking about a $3 billion product, so it's it's no small industry, is it? Patrick Connell's also with me. Patrick's a farmer. You're in South Australia, Patrick. Whereabouts?
That's right. We're at Riverton, just north of Adelaide, about 100 k's.
Okay, and you've had this this virus in your crop. How did you come across it?
Well, I don't know. It took a while. We're a bit slow off the mark, really, working out what was wrong. We often have aphids feeding on canola, and generally then they do some damage from feeding, so you spray them and the problem's solved. But in this case, I guess that's what we thought, but they had, in fact, infected the virus. When they eat, they bring the virus to the plant, and we sprayed them and the problem didn't go away, took a while.
So what happened with your crop?
Well, depending when they're infected, some crops were written off. If they're infected at an early growth stage, it seems, they don't tend to recover very well. Some crops were ploughed in, basically, or sprayed out and re-sown. The crops that were a bit more advanced, it seems, when the aphid came, aren't affected as badly, but we still don't know. We're all very unsure about it all. We don't know what to expect, really.
Mm. It seems strange, Ken, that if it happens each year, this I don't think I've actually given it the name. It's the beet western yellow virus. If we see it each year, how come there's no cure or spray that does the trick?
I don't know. We do see it each year. There may be, we're speaking a lot with the people now that know Jenny Davidson's been particularly helpful and Trent and others. I think it's very isolated most years. It may be there, but at such a minimal degree, probably because the green peach aphid is the key, I think. Other aphids can transmit the disease, but not nearly as efficiently. The green peach is actually terrific at his job. 97% of the plants that he eats become infected.
Mm.
Seems that the cool autumn, summer, wet weather, green growth on the roadsides, etc., allowed the virus to multiply and also the aphid to be in good numbers, to be detrimental. I think in a normal year, perhaps, you might get perhaps 5% infection of a paddock, and we might not even notice it. You might see the odd dead plant, but canola is a great compensator. It probably just branches out and you don't notice those missing plants this year.
Trent, what do you put it down to? Do you think the climate and the weather conditions in autumn are a contributing factor?
I think they are. I mean, I've worked on canola for 38 years or so now, and I've never seen a situation like this in the past. So we had big rains in mid-February, other big rains in March, and then we had incredibly mild April and May, and to my way of thinking, that's just helped basically to kick the aphid population along, and therefore they've been able to transmit the disease when the canola plants were very small. So it has been an exceptionally different sort of season.
Ken, if we put to one side the export value of the crop, why else is it important for farmers?
Well, canola provides a good break crop. It's a good rotational crop from our cereals, and that's it's a financial crop, but it gives a good break for diseases. And in certain situations, it also gives a break from a change of for weed control as well. Able to give different herbicides to be able to use, or different tactics to be able to bring into those crops.
What does that mean? Does it mean if I plant wheat after canola, I get a better yield?
Correct, yes. So if we just grew cereal on cereal, you'll tend to build up a range of diseases and possibly insects. And you also select for a range of type of weeds because your sowing times are the same, you know, row spacings, etc. And they select for a range of things, of diseases and weeds, and to a certain extent insects as well. And by having a range of crops in rotation allows, you know, longer time between those crops, so therefore the diseases will slow down.
Okay. So, Patrick, you grow it. Do you calculate how much improvement in yield you might get from your cereal crops because you have canola in the rotation?
Oh, I don't know that we can be specific about that, but as Ken said, it's a rotation. You can't grow, you can't have monocropping. You must have variation, so it's just a given, I think. I don't know that we put any figures on it that way. One of the rotations that we can use, that's important.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's we haven't grown it in Australia for a terribly long time, though, have we? So you must have been able to get by without it in the years gone by.
Yes, I suppose it was around here probably 30 years ago, and then it phased out. It's been back now, I don't know, 20, perhaps. Certainly Trent would know better. He's worked in a lot more than we have. It's a crop we don't always grow. We go in and out of it, unfortunately. We're out last year and now we're back in this year. And I'll say it's an important part of rotation, but it is gives you flexibility. It's a crop we do grow and not grow, but we wouldn't like to not be able to grow it anymore.
Okay. Ken, finally to you, what happens from here? What action can be taken?
Well, the work that's going on at the present moment is, as both Trent and Patrick have said, the virus is spread by aphids, and the major vector is a single a species of aphid called green peach aphid. Its survival over the summer on weeds build up the populations. Now, they've been decreased a little bit over the winter with a colder climate, but now spring's temperature's starting to move again. Those aphids will go out and they'll start becoming mature and go on what we call winged aphids, and they can fly and they can then move from currently infested crops into uninfested crops.
Okay.
So growers need to be vigilant, have monitoring. We're putting sticky traps out there to collect the aphids so they can see when aphid flights start to occur and then look at the appropriate management options of insecticides on those aphids. But we also need to really identify what those aphids are. As said, and Patrick alluded to, that the green peach aphid it has the greatest transmission of the virus, where the other aphids are a lot lower. Things like the cabbage aphid and things like that are only around 20% transmission, where the green peach is up around the 90%.
Yeah, okay. All right, thanks a lot, Ken. Dr. Ken Young, Plant Health Manager with the Grains Research and Development Corporation. You also heard from Trent Potter. My thanks to Trent, Agricultural Consultant at Narracourt and Vice President of the Australian Oilseeds Association. And Patrick, good luck with the farming. Patrick Connell, canola farmer in the mid-north of South Australia, quite close to Riverton. Before I head off for the day, on Monday we told you about Zoos Victoria's plan to use Maremma dogs to guard bandicoots, certain species of bandicoot that's in a fair bit of trouble. We got this really nice message from Bianca about Maremma dogs, which you tend to tell us about your love of these dogs when we do a story. Marimmas are an amazing and versatile guardian animal. I've had the privilege of owning and working with several of these. My absolute favourite is an animal named Bear, who bonded with my children. What an experience. He was within 3 metres of them day and night. Even if I took the kids to the swimming pool at the river, over 4 kilometres away, he would follow and look after us. If we were shearing, he would be there, over 6 kilometres away, mustering sheep around the stock. Bianca goes on to tell us about the relationship with the kids had with Bear, the Maremma dog, and some of the amazing feats that Maremmas are capable of. So you can find that for yourself on our Facebook page. That'll do us for today. Up next on RN, news for you, then the world today. See you tomorrow.
G'day, beloved listeners. Issue 5 of White Paper is out now, and in this issue, RN's journos explore war and conflict around the world and across time. Guest writer John Bale, a fourth-generation soldier, draws on personal experience to examine Australia's relationship with its veterans. So follow the White Paper link on RN's homepage to download now for your iPad.